Thank you, and welcome everybody to the final concurrent session of the 2015 Actuary Summit. So over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of discussion around group life experience, particularly around TPD, and also around income protection experience. Perhaps one product that hasn't had a lot of focus recently is trauma. Just come from a session where Eddie and Bri Allen were presenting on experience studies, and I guess they've shown how trauma claims have been increasing by about 4% per annum. It's also a product where medical advances obviously have a significant impact on the experience of the products. So here to discuss that today are Graham Kelly and Dr. Bill Murray. Graham Kelly is a senior actuary in terms of trade at Munich Re. Prior to that, he was director of pricing and value analytics at AMP. During a long career at AMP, he held senior actuarial roles in the life insurance, wealth management and superannuation sectors, including experience and product pricing and design, financial reporting, capital management and contributions to public policy. Dr. Bill Murray is presently Chief Medical Officer for Munich Re Australia, a position he's held since July 2012. As way of background, Bill qualified from Cape Town University in 1987, continued postgraduate studies as Registrar of Wits Medical School in Johannesburg. During the time he spent as a registrar in Johannesburg, Bill spent 2 years in the cardiology unit and 2 years in the renal transplant unit and developed a special interest in renal medicine. Bill joined the insurance industry in 1997, and since then he has acted as CMO both in insurance and reinsurance in the South African and Australian market. Bill enjoys knowledge transfer and keeping the insurance industry abreast of advances in medicine. So to kick it all off, I'll ask Graham to come up, please.
Thanks, Stephen. So, yes, trauma. Yes, as Stephen alluded to, it's probably fallen a bit under the radar in terms of actuarial public discussion in recent times, but we do see it as something of a problem child. And today's main talk is around medical advances, and I'm looking forward to Bill talking about those, and I'm sure you'll find them interesting. But I thought I would start by setting a scene, so I'll just talk about recent experience and profitability and one or two other things, and then the bulk of the presentation will be Bill's on various aspects of medical advances in trauma. So, a problem child. At MRA, we've been doing a lot of portfolio review recently, we've talked at some insight sessions and other things about DI, but we're also finding that in our view, the industry is having significant profitability issues around trauma. So our own portfolio shows that it's not confined to one client or two clients. It's a general industry issue. Why? Well, this is MRA's trauma experience from 2007 to 2013. A few bumps along the way, but there's clearly one direction that it's happened. And this picture is not inconsistent with the 2009 to 2011 industry analysis that was performed by KPMG, that I believe was a subject of a previous concurrent session. Our rise is a little bit steeper, I think, for credibility, but also I understand the industry investigation showed that A over E's by some insured were higher than by count, something which had not been previously observed. So being a reinsurer, Munich Re has a portfolio that's a bit skewed to higher sums insured and therefore has probably experienced some worse deterioration as a result. Why the experience deterioration? A number of factors, but product changes must be a major culprit. Liberalisation of definitions and additional benefits, particularly partial benefits. In the early part of that period, partial benefits were added to trauma products across by most companies, and while it slowed down recently or stopped, we're now reaping what we have sowed. So that's experience and profitability. Well, The premium, while we haven't done an in-depth analysis of past premium rate rises in the industry, it's certain that the premiums have not kept up with the claims and therefore a profitability issue. Now let me just turn to a few things on product. So trauma products have been discussed a lot over the years, so I won't talk a lot, but product design, we have very long and complex definitions, and I'm sure the consumers don't understand them, and that probably doesn't lead to too many issues, in that mostly if someone has a trauma event, they'll recognise it, hopefully know they've got cover and claim. But you still have, there's probably some silent heart attacks or other things that could have happened that, and in theory, would pass the definition on for some products, but haven't claimed. So, it's there is a latent aspect there. I think there was a talk at one of a previous conference on the lottery effect of trauma, where for many people the amount of cover that the sum insured they get paid is significantly in excess of the costs of what they bear, of the event that leads to the claim. And the lottery effect then leads to effectively higher costs for everybody, higher premium rates and affordability issues. So let me just turn to affordability. Just some sample premium rates. So male life, male trauma, male non-smokers, what you already know, trauma is much, much more expensive than death, and this really starts to matter at the more advanced ages. So, consequences, lapse rates by age. So from probably 40, between 40 and 45, lapse rates for trauma start to rise. Also, it's not in the slide, but our investigation showed that of all the major product streams, trauma is most influenced by age. If you look at DI, death, etc., there's many influences on lapse rates, but trauma is the one that's most influenced by age, which definitely shows affordability is a significant contributor to that effect. So we have, I think, something of a problem child, because we have a profitability issue, but the product is already fairly expensive. So where to from here? Anyway, with that, probably not such a great scene, I will now hand over to Bill, who will talk about one aspect. Certainly those long definitions and complex definitions and numerical definitions definitely render the product vulnerable to medical advances. So I'm sure you'll find what Bill has to say quite interesting. Bill.
A bit doomy and gloomy. First of all, I must congratulate you all for coming to an afternoon session on medical aspects. Are there any medics in the room? No. So I'm feeling a bit under pressure with all this sea of actuaries in front of me, but I shall do my best. I must say I enjoy the trauma product, and I find it fascinating, and I really thank you for the opportunity to talk today, to speak about medicine and trauma. So let's get on. This is a South African development, and just to realize that it's now a 32-year-old product, critical illness. And if you look at the mobile phone from 83, if you look at the Apple computer from 83, maybe the car still looks okay. But, we've got a product that hasn't really changed that much in 32 years. And I can tell you an awful lot has changed in medicine. So we have to be very careful. And I'm getting more and more concerned as I read journals on a weekly basis of all the developments that are happening in medicine that can affect trauma. So what are the general advances? Well, we're moving from a diagnose and treat to predict and prevent, so predictive medicine. So have your screening, start looking more and more at genetics and so forth. Lifestyle changes, controlling risk factors, that's impacting our cardiac experience because people are stopping smoking and so forth and addressing the cholesterol. I'll go into a bit more detail about that. There's enhanced diagnostics and imaging. It's more sensitive, so we'll be able to pick up smaller strokes and so forth. So it's going to impact on the incidence rates of something like stroke. Okay. There's targeted therapy now, specialized therapy for certain cancers and so forth. It's becoming extremely expensive, and you wonder whether Medicare can keep up with this. And is there a role in the future for the insurance world to assist more with the cost of these really expensive drugs that are coming out? And I'll share some numbers with you. Okay. Genetics, genomics, and personalized medicine. We had a meeting at the FSC with geneticists last week, and they are asking us, well, what are you going to do when your clients give you their whole genome sequence because you asked for the genetic tests if they've been done? What are you going to do with it? Okay, so there's some interesting questions that are coming out. Obviously, big data, electronic records, we're going to get more information. How can we handle it? What can we do with it? And so forth. Longevity, more for long-term care, affecting long-term care, so not so much in this market. And then, obviously, we're hoping for a compression of ill health. So you live longer, and then you're just ill for a shorter period of time. That's the aim of medicine, I guess. There's new surgical techniques coming out all the time, so your definitions have to keep up with the new surgical techniques. You're going to fall behind. So it really behoves you to look at your trauma definitions on every year or every couple of years to see that they've kept up to date. Okay. And with all these advances, don't forget the old enemies at the gate. So everyone is getting concerned around the world about antibiotic resistance and so forth. So we have to keep that in the back of our mind and think of the consequences of that. So GPs are being told not to give as many antibiotics out and so forth. Okay. All right. So we're moving into a new word, a new area. It's called omics. So we have genetics, and we know the sort of autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive kind of genetics, and that started in the 1980s. But now we're moving on to genomics, which is really looking at the whole of your all of your genes together, your whole genome, and interaction with lifestyle factors and so forth. And then we've got pharmacogenomics, which is quite fascinating, because this is how medicine actually interacts with your genetic makeup. So it's being used today. So some people have to go into blood thinning agents called warfarin, and they have a genetic test to see whether the warfarin will work in your case, and the same after a stent and so forth. Okay, so what we have to really ask ourselves is, with the tremendous acceleration in medical knowledge, is it possible to future-proof this product? The impact on mortality and morbidity, incidence and prevalence. Building in trends. Are we building in trends? Are they strong enough? Changing definitions, I've mentioned. And is the current product sustainable? A show of hands, some interaction. Who thinks that this trauma product is sustainable?
What?
Right, okay. Thank you, thanks. And if only one person thinks it's sustainable, then what have we got to do? We've got to change the product design, have we? All right, so some food for thought. So most of our cancer claims our trauma claims are cardiac and cancer, predominantly cancer. So let's just look at those two areas. So 80% of the female trauma claims will be cancer, and 50% of the male trauma claims will be cancer, roughly. Okay. So actually, Australia is looking very good as far as the cardiac state of affairs. So sorry, it's a slide you may not be able to read, but at the top graph, the red line is how mortality is decreasing for cardiovascular disease, and it's probably because people are addressing their lifestyle risks. So smoking is at about 20% of the population, where if you go into Asia, Indonesia, it could be as high as 50% and above. Okay. The only blip is the obesity epidemic, and that's something that has to be really addressed. Okay. And along with obesity, the impact that that's really threatening mortality improvement is obesity. And there were some articles that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2013 saying for the first time that mortality improvement has slowed down or even gone backwards a little bit because of obesity. And with obesity comes diabetes. So look at that that statistic there. World diabetes cases expected to jump 55% by 2035. So that's incredible. China having 100 million diabetics. It's an awful lot of people. Okay. So I know a recent industry report looked at the experience, and they weren't concerned about the cardiac experience, and that's because the number of heart attacks in Australia are actually decreasing, if you look at that graph. And it is because people are addressing their lifestyle risk and so forth. So even though we've got far more sensitive blood tests now for detecting heart attacks, something called highly sensitive troponin, because the number of infarcts is actually decreasing, the experience is quite flat around myocardial infarcts. It shouldn't keep you awake at night as far as myocardial infarcts and experience there. And what medicine is looking at now more and more is the bottom. That's a clever picture taken of the inside of coronary arteries with all the different types of cholesterol. The different colors are different types of cholesterol. And we know that different types of cholesterol rupture more easily. So half the people who have a heart attack have a normal cholesterol level. So it's not so much the quantity, it's the quality of cholesterol. So they'll be looking more and more at that, and new drugs will maybe coming in to try and scavenge and remove the cholesterol from inside the coronary arteries and so forth. Another reason why the cardiac experience is okay is that less and less people are having coronary artery bypass grafts, and more people are having stents. And so instead of having a full payment for a coronary artery bypass graft, you've got a partial payment for a stent. Okay. The only thing to note that multiple stenting or triple stent vessel stenting, where most companies pay 100%, has been increasing at about 6% per annum. So that's just, but they seem to be balancing each other out. Okay. The picture on the right is how medicine is advancing and how you have to change your definitions. They're now doing valve replacements. Instead of doing a big cut down the middle of the chest and opening the heart, they're doing valve replacements when it's possible through the groin, like when you have an angioplasty. Okay, so it's a much, much smaller procedure. You recover a lot quicker and so forth. And so in the past, some definitions have excluded this kind of surgery for payment, but as we move forward, more and more and more surgical procedures on the heart will be done through a catheter, so you have to start covering this kind of thing. So if I just put all this lot up. So at the moment, on the left of the curve, most valve replacements are open surgery, but it's expected that over the next years the catheter approach will increase quite dramatically, and so if you don't cover that, your clients are going to lose out. Okay, so really, I'm watching my time. I don't want to spend too much on the cardiac side of things, but it's pretty flat and it looks okay. We're doing okay there. But what my concern and my message really is to look at cancer today. So cancer, according to the World Health Organization, Australian men have the highest incidence of cancer in the world. And maybe that's due to a combination of perhaps melanoma and prostate cancer. Okay, the mortality is not the highest in the world. It's just the actual incidence. Okay, so we have to keep this in the back of our mind. Okay, our product definitions have loosened, haven't they? So now this is ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS. Okay, and products now cover this condition as well. And if you look at the bottom dotted line, that is the incidence of ductal carcinoma under the age of 50. It's about 5 per 100,000. At the age of 50, breast screen kicks in Australia. Okay. And so the top dotted line is after the age of 50. So it jumps from 5 per 100,000 to 50 per 100,000. Okay. So that's quite a dramatic increase. And breast screen would have something to do with that. Obviously, as you age, your risk increases as well. Okay. So screening is very important. And I'm going to be spending some slides to show you what future screening is going to be happening. Okay. So I think this graph is quite telling. If you look at the bottom graph, there's a blip at 1994 on the incidence rate of prostate cancer. That was when PSA was introduced. Okay. And the cases of prostate cancer screamed up. It's a top dotted line on the top graph. And so the impact of screening with a blood test like PSA certainly saw the number of claims going up. Now, in the last 5 years or so, it's been realized that the mortality has not decreased for prostate cancer, even though all these men are having their prostatectomies. So in medicine, first do no harm. So they're actually, so instead of demanding that the patient has a PSA over the age of 40, they're now debating it. And so less PSAs are being done, because you don't want to give somebody impotence or incontinence, right? And then, you know, they're not going to die from their prostate cancer. So the number of prostate PSAs being performed now has reduced, and so we're seeing a leveling off of PSA and prostate cancer. Okay. Perhaps a more significant screening, the impact of screening, an example is in Korea, and I think we all know this by now. But they've got 5 million people with critical illness cover in Korea. And I think a number of years ago, it was decided that everyone who's going to be employed for pre-employment can have an ultrasound of their neck. And the rate of thyroid cancer in Korea went up 16% per annum. And this is just tremendous. It had an enormous impact. So one third of all claims, of all trauma claims in women, and 10% of all claims in men, was due to thyroid cancer. Now, normally thyroid cancer is about 2-3% of all cancers. So to have a third of all your trauma claims due to thyroid cancer, they've lost, or they've had to put aside hundreds of millions of dollars to pay for these claims. Okay. And they've had to exclude early stage thyroid cancer from their products now. Okay. Because actually, if you get thyroid cancer early and you treat it, the cure rate is just about 100%. And I'm, with the present product design in this country, you can get up to $2 million, and I have certainly paid claims of $500,000 and $600,000 for stage one thyroid cancer. Okay, so, right. None of you look like that at this point in time, so thank you. Tumor markers, so detecting cancer. This is where an awful lot of advances are happening at the moment. So we need to understand tumor markers and what that's going to mean for us and the trauma product. Okay. So they've realized that cancer cells produce unique proteins, and they've all got those funny names there. Okay. So PSA, going back to the prostate cancer, PSA is a test, but PSA can be raised in benign prostatic hypertrophy, in infection, and prostate cancer. So it's not very good, actually, as a screening tool. But now they've realized that prostate cancer produces a specific protein, and that's that black cloud, PCA3. So if you detect that, you know that you've got prostate cancer. And so they've developed a urine test now to look for this. Okay, and it's out. It came out in 2013. It's not being used widely yet because it costs $1,000 a shot. But as it's used more and more, the price will come down. And what's interesting for those who are more cynical of us, if it's a urine test, you can do it at home. You know, there's no needles that have to go in. So can you test yourself for prostate cancer with a quick urine test at home? Right. So now this anti-selection concern comes up a little bit. All right. And there's going to be more and more and more urine testing for cancers. And because those proteins are specific for cancer, if the test is positive, you have cancer, that cancer. Okay. One of my actuary colleagues sent this to me last week or the week before, and it's a study that said they're looking at the ends of chromosomes, and the ends of the chromosomes change in people who are going to develop cancer. And so along with Harvard University, they're looking at this, and they feel as if they can predict whether a person is going to develop cancer in the future in the years ahead by looking at the end of the chromosomes. Okay, so that came out this month. Right, here's another omic, a saliva omic. All right, so we now know that urine can be used to detect cancer, so there's also saliva tests coming out now to detect cancer as well. So at the moment, it's potential to detect oral cancer, pancreatic cancer, lung, ovarian, and breast cancer. So that's another thing that you could do at home and send off to a lab. Okay. So it's getting a bit worrying. Okay, and then if that wasn't enough, and I haven't convinced you yet that we're going to pick up cancer earlier and earlier, well, frankly, the dog can sniff out cancer as well. Okay, so this is sort of, you think Bill's lost his, you know, he's losing it by putting this up. But what they've realized is that these cancers that produce these unique proteins, these proteins are volatile. Okay, and so all the blood's going through the lungs, so that the proteins can diffuse out from the blood into the lung with these volatile amines, and you're doing gas spectrometry and so forth, you'll see a spike if that compound is there. So you'll be breathing into a machine and looking like the gas, a spike, and if that spike is there, then you've got the cancer. And because the blood is from the whole body, it's not restricted to lung cancer. Okay, so it's a case of give me a urine test, blow in this tube, and give me a saliva test. All right, and that's quite interesting. All that's going to be rolling out in the next number of years. How am I doing for time? Okay, good. It would be nice to have a golden retriever in every doctor's rooms, but I think they'll be replacing them with machines. All right. This is the Bible of cancer statistics. So the surveillance and epidemiology report and studies from the States, over 3 million people. And you'll see that by far most of cancers are diagnosed in stage one. Okay. And with all these tests that are coming out, you can imagine a shift to the left and more cancers being detected in stage one. And we don't really, we say that, you know, if you've got cancer, we pay up to $2 million. Okay. And so what I see and what we're all seeing is that with all these tests, you're going to get more and more in stage one. And it's really a windfall for them if they get a large sum of money because it's usually curable. Okay. Quite easily curable. Good. So that's really one of my important take-home messages, is that cancer detection is going to be a lot easier in the next number of years, and it doesn't mean sticking a needle into somebody either. Okay, I think that luckily, I mean, we're going to reap the benefits of picking up cancer earlier from a mortality and morbidity perspective, but from an incidence perspective for trauma, we might run into some problems. Okay. And I'm seeing, I work in claims as well, and I just see an awful lot of melanomas, prostate cancer, and breast cancer coming across the desks. Okay. So another aspect where medicine is advancing quickly is the treatment of cancer, and sort of cynically called slash burn and poison, because the treatment that we have up until recently really is you cut it out, all right, you burn it with radiotherapy, or you poison the person with chemotherapy and hopefully kill the cancer cells as well, but you also lose your hair and all this, that, and the other. Okay. So what's happening now is that the medicine, the treatment is changing. Okay. So there's an artist's impression on top, on the right, of a blue drug, knocking on the door of the cancer cell and saying, well, I've targeted you. I've got a lock and key. They're building drugs that have a special, they will only attach to the cancer cells. Once they're attached to the cancer cells, they deliver their payload, their nuclear bomb of chemotherapy. And so you're going to kill all the cancer cells. You're not going to lose your hair. You're not going to have bowel problems and all this, that, and the other. And you're going to hit all the cancer cells. Okay, so it's very clever. And they even, the bottom one is gold. They're actually having these nanoparticles with gold in them. The gold goes into the cancer cells, and they use an external beam to heat that gold up a little bit, and that destroys the cell. Okay. It's not a lot of gold. There's no, so you're not going to be having a sieve and waiting for it to come out. These treatments are really for advanced cancer, okay, sort of stage 3 and stage 4 cancer, but it's the cost that's worrying, okay, all right. And then they've realized that with genetics in the past, they just homed in precisely on genes, but there's areas of the DNA in between the genes, and those areas in between the genes regulate the genes. We have something called tumor suppressor genes, and that name says it all. Those genes suppress you from getting tumors. But what happens if those tumor suppressor genes are down-regulated? Well, then you develop a cancer or a tumor. We also have something called oncogenes, which promote cell growth. Well, what happens if they are up-regulated and the cells divide too much? You get cancer. Okay. So there's an awful lot of work going on. Epigenetics is looking at the up and down regulation of genes, and this is a new area for treatment. Okay, and so we're seeing this come out. And there's also drugs that attach to antibodies, and the drug goes directly to the cancer. Cancer also needs to grow. It needs nutrition. So there are new drugs that starve the blood vessels going to the cancer. So if there's no nutrition, the cancer can't grow. Okay. So there's all new kinds of treatment coming out that just wasn't there before. All right. And we're also using, now this is very interesting, it's a very busy slide, but we're looking at the genetic fingerprint of the cancer itself. And you've got a one on the right and one on the left. The important thing on the right graph is 100 months, and it's telling us that with that genetic makeup of that cancer, the prostate will take more than 8 years to double in size. But if you've got the genetic fingerprint on the left, in under 3 years, that prostate cancer will double in size. So if you're a man and you're weighing up about whether you should have a prostatectomy or not, this kind of information will be useful to decide how we're going to be treating you. Okay, so this is actually the next level of looking at cancer, and it might start to come into underwriting as well, because there's obviously a big difference in mortality, and so we can start using that to offer better rates and so forth when we're underwriting cases, if we know that kind of information. So at the moment, that's a busy slide, but we use all the top little blocks to be able to drill down to give you a rating when you apply for insurance and you've had breast cancer, and the line at the bottom is now making it possible for us to start drilling down even further, which makes underwriting more complex but more scientific. And then this is also fascinating. So what better defense do we have than our own body's immune system? Okay, it's the cleverest thing out. So what they're now doing is they're using vaccines. They inject a mutated protein from a cancer early on into the person, and then the body learns to detect that cancer. So as soon as the cancer starts to grow, the immune system zaps it, but it doesn't grow. Okay. So you'll see more and more and more cancer vaccines coming in the years ahead, which is fantastic. So if you can prevent the cancer from ever happening, that's probably the best treatment you could ask for. Okay. So this is in early stages of development now. Okay. But look at the cost of all of this, and this is where I wonder if the insurance industry has to think about where we can assist here, because if you look at the States, the increase in prescription drugs rose 13%, which is $43 billion in 2013. $11 billion went to pay for four new drugs just for hepatitis C, and that's available now in this country at $90,000. So it's basically it's $80,000 to $90,000 for a 12-week course. It's $1,000 a tablet. If you lose those, you're in trouble. Medicare is paying for it. Okay, so it's amazing. Australia's got the most fantastic Medicare, but can they afford to keep doing this? Okay, so new specialty medicines now account for a third of all prescription drug spending in the USA, and you've got to ask, can Medicare keep afford to doing this? And there's often about a two-year lag from the drug coming out before Medicare agrees to pay for it. And if it's going to prolong your life, you're going to want to pay for it, aren't you? So it's important that our trauma products are able to cover this cost. Okay. Just on moving now onto genomics and genetics, you saw at the beginning of the presentation that in 1983, when the trauma product came out, we knew of one genetic test, Huntington's chorea. Now there's over 2,200 available. It cost $100 million to do the first genome sequencing. Now it's less than $1,000. Okay. So this is a very real question that we're being asked, and we have to think about this more and more, is how are we going to manage, how are we going to interpret whole genome sequencing when our clients start having this done? Okay. And there's not an answer to this at this point in time. We're going to have to rely, look, we can discriminate in insurance as long as we can provide actuarial data to back it up. Okay. So we're going to have to look at bodies such as this one here, which actually is doing the work for us. So they're saying, okay, if you do have a look at the genome profiling, can you say that the person is definitely going to get diabetes? No, you can't. Okay. But there's, you know, more complex things at the bottom. You can. And so we're just going to have to be guided by this, but it's certainly going to need a lot of interaction with geneticists in this area. And it's a really rapidly expanding field. Oops, sorry, gone wrong way. All right. And then this is one that worries me as well, is direct-to-consumer genetic testing. I've used a slide before in presentations of this Who's Your Daddy van, where this van goes around New York, parks on the curb, and you can run in and get your kid tested to see whether it's your kid or not. So, you know, if you're worried about maintenance. But this is not regulated, okay? So in Australia, I was speaking to the geneticist last week, you're not allowed to do a genetic test in Australia unless it goes through a doctor, okay? But there's nothing to stop anyone going overseas and having a genetic test, okay? And there is no regulation around this. So you can go into Walmart and get your genetic test off the shelf and test yourself. You know, this kind of scenario, I mean, exaggerating a little bit, but it's something to be quite concerned about. Okay, and it's our insured population that will be quite savvy around this. All right, so in summary, there's been a deterioration in trauma experience, and as actuaries you will all be aware of that. I really do think that of all the product lines, the trauma product is exposed to advances in medicine, both positively and negatively. Okay, cancer is the most affected, and that's where we see the most claims. Okay. All right. I think screening and new diagnostics will increase the incidence of cancer detection and shift the stage of diagnosis to the left. It's not necessary to pay $2 million for these cases. Okay. So that's important. Genetic testing will become more important. The FSC have got a subcommittee going there. and it's important we work with the geneticists and we stay up to date in this area, and we have to be very aware of the possibilities of anti-selection in the future. Okay, so that's what I'm saying. New surgical techniques are coming out all the time, like I showed you with that aortic valve replacement, so definitions are going to have to change. And I really do think that the sustainability of the product, if it's left as it was in 1983, it's under real serious threat. And I hope I've given you a few examples of how medicine is really advancing so quickly that it will affect the trauma product and the experience, where we're already seeing this concern of a 4% deterioration and so forth annually. So thank you for surviving some time on medicine. You're a very good audience, and I think it's really best for an actuary to speak to the actuaries and conclude the presentation. So I'm going to hand over back to Graham. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Bill. And I found that firstly very interesting. I've seen aversion before, and I guess the option of doing nothing, leaving the product as is, looks even much less attractive following what Bill has talked about. But there's huge opportunity, I thought, in what Bill has presented as well. The change in the cancer, as well as threat. There's the movement of more cancer to stage one. The fact that the product has to be redesigned in some way presents tremendous opportunity. So I think I'll perhaps conclude there, and we can now take questions or discussion.
Yes, so if you'd like to ask some questions, please step up to the mic because these sessions are being recorded.
Eddie Fabrizio, is any person put up the hand saying sustainable? I probably will tell you why. Thank you very much for the discussion. I mean, 10 years ago, I think we said the same type of things, that this was not a sustainable product. Everything was going to fall apart. The fact that incident rates keep going up, well, that's an insurance product. We know a lot of other insurance products where incidence goes up. You look at TPD, you look at disability income. I think your presentation was really good. It was really balanced because it was like showing, here's all the medical detection things which are going to cause a lot of problems, incidents coming up. But at the same time, there's a lot of things happening on vaccines and preventive medicine which is going to come and bring it down. How those two balance each other out is going to be really interesting to play out. My own view is like cardiovascular disease is going to disappear as an issue, right, probably in the next 10, 15 years, and we've seen an ongoing trend. If I think 5 years ago when the definition of heart attack, myocardial infarction was changing and all the reinsurers and insurance companies were running around saying it's going to cause a 30% increase.
Yeah.
Thank you for that data, because that's the first data I've seen now where it basically said, no, it's continuing to come down, even with that more up-to-date definition. So my view is that, yeah, there's going to be some changes to the trauma product in the future. There'll be little shifts here in definitions there, and that's always been going on for the last 10 years. But I don't think that means that the whole product's going to suddenly fall apart. And that's why I say I think it is a sustainable product. Price is obviously going to have to vary over time.
Yeah.
I was joking with Andrew before, saying what we sell today is a medical lotto product. And the arguments to go back about whether $2 million or $1 million is too much, well, we knew that 10, 15 years ago. But that's not what we sell today. And I don't think we're ever going to get back to the argument to say this is a pseudo health insurance cover where it's supposed to cover for the cost of medical treatment. You're not allowed to do that in Australia.
No,
that's health insurance. This is a lifestyle product. And who knows how a person's lifestyle is impacted upon a diagnosis of something, even if it's something that's either easily treated and can survive from.
Eddie, I know you're an absolute expert in this field, so thank you for saying that. I think I wouldn't advocate changing everything, but I really do think the cancer must be addressed, because I really see an awful lot of in situ cancers coming in, stage one cancers, 400,000 to 500,000. And some, if you have an early stage melanoma, you have it cut out in the rooms, you know, back at work in the afternoon or the next day, and they're getting these large amounts of payment. So it's food for thought. That's what I really wanted for you to think about.
Anthony Bryan, I'm not sure if there's anyone from FIAC here, but it would be interesting to see. I think what the life industry seems to have not noticed is that after the Blue Cross or Silver Cross product, which was the real fight about what is health insurance, what is life insurance, the definition of health insurance has changed. So it's very narrow now about the reimbursement of medical costs. So there's a big opportunity to have payments of lump sum dollar amounts for medical conditions. So there's an opportunity there potentially. One of the other things which I haven't seen a life company yet do is Section 9A of the Life Act requires a 3-year minimum duration for a trauma type product. But after that duration, there's no reason why you can't put in there that definitions can be reviewable. There's potentially an opportunity there to say, rather than having these legacy products with different definitions at set points in time, why can't we build a product that has a certain guarantee period in it and then evolves into whatever's coming up? Maybe there's some opportunity for innovation in what's going on in the future with these sorts of products.
Thank you.
I guess that bell was for 5 minutes, sorry.
Greg Martin, just a question, Graeme. You had your claims experience going up and you had a ratio that goes over 100%. What is that of? Is that of the marginal loading, which doesn't include the bit where you save on the mortality? So I suppose I'm getting at, are you saying that you think the industry is losing money on the whole gig? Or
we don't have overall industry stats, but based on our analysis, we believe trauma is a loss-making product.
But what I'm getting at is when you price your product, you normally charge full price for mortality, and then you charge the rider loading.
Okay,
the extra stuff which allows for the fact that the basic product and what materialises a trauma claim. And not a death. So when you say actual over expected, I'm always a bit wary with TPD and trauma as whether we've counted the life saving that we don't pay, because that's the way the product actually works. KPMG's mortality studies, I'll show you that, you know, rider mortality is 50% of non-rider, because some of that actually paid for the rider.
I can assure you that our analysis does take that effect into account, Greg. Yeah.
So everyone put their price up.
I was just going to ask a quick question. How big an issue do you think this anti-selective thing, but now it's so easy to get genetic tests. There was a session yesterday with Kent Hopper around, I guess, increasing use of wearables and all of that sort of stuff. How much do you think that's going to come into play?
We've got some anecdotal signs. In the UK market, it's always been picked up that we're anti-selected against in breast cancer. The percentage of breast cancers in the Australian of female cancers in the population is 20%, and our own experience from Munich is 50% of our claims are breast cancer. So there's some differences there, and at the moment we're looking at all our early claims and seeing if we can pick up something and going through it. I think anti-selection does exist. Yep. Thank you.
Probably got time for one further question. No?
Brian Cummings, KPMG. I might just comment on the anti-selection comment in that in the experience-based cases that we do, when we started the investigations, they're looking at data since 2004-2006, we saw strong selection effects, particularly for males, which was very much changed from the previous studies back in the late 90s. But now in the most recent one, we're seeing no evidence of selection, but also no evidence of any selection. apart from cancer, where we, for males, where we see a strong evidence for anti-selection.
Well, thank you. I think that's a very informative session. I think originally I'm perhaps expecting it to be quite negative, but it looks like there is some light at the end of the tunnel. So I'd like you to join me in thanking Dr. Bill and Graham for their thoughts.